Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and it is September 9th as you are listening to this, which means the college coaches are now allowed to, or Division I coaches, excuse me, are allowed to contact players in the class of 2028. I am recording this on the afternoon of September 8th with new Mercer head coach James Chaikey. Coach Chaikey, thanks so much for joining. Congratulations on the new gig.
Thanks, Terry. I appreciate it. And I don't know if it should have a lot of pressure or not. This is getting released on the 9th, but I'm excited about it. And it's the best time of year. We finally get to talk to some kids we've been watching for over a year.
No doubt. So we're going to get into a lot, including what it's been like to go from being an assistant at Brown to being the head coach at Mercer over the course of the summer. And I would imagine that you're in the camp where the 9 additional days have been very useful in terms of additional time to prepare. But we got to start the same place we always do, which is, how do you describe yourself as an evaluator?
Yeah, it's my favorite question to kick everything off. I'm a multi-sport guy. So I kind of look at some of the intangibles of, you know, footwork, maybe not lacrosse footwork, but how guys move in the middle of the field versus inside the box, maybe just on the offense or defensive side of the field. So I'm always looking at things like your motor, getting on and off the field hard, right? The body posture piece, like things you develop from playing multiple sports kind of throughout your life. So I'm always looking at that first, and then the intangibles of, you know, footwork from a defensive perspective in the lacrosse world, right? Stick work, off ball, you know, as an offensive player, like what do you do off ball? So I would say my steps really are, how are you as an athlete? You know, can you do a lot of things versus, you know, are you one dimensional on the athlete side? And then two would kind of tie into like attitude towards the game of lacrosse. Like, can you use those intangibles to support your stick skills, support the ability to get the ball up and off the ground, to play one-on-one defense or beat a man, you know, with simplicity, right? Or in a complex way when dodging, right? So that's kind of my tiers, right? If a guy checks that first box, I'm likely to continue to watch that player and see what he can do with the stick in his hand or, you know, on or off ball on the offense or defense side.
It can be coach speak to say that I'm a multi-sport athlete guy, but you come by it honestly and in a way that's not very common to lacrosse. You went to the Haverford School, so in that way, common, total hotbed, played for John Nostrand. We'll come back to that. But you were a baseball guy early and late, really. And that's not a common crossover because, number one, both sports are played in the spring. And number two, baseball doesn't have the same set of athletic attributes that say, whether it's the physicality of football or the tactics of basketball, that directly relate to lacrosse. So share a little bit about your baseball background and how do you think you took that to inform your lacrosse perspective?
Yeah, sure. I'll be honest, Terry. I was extremely lucky to attend the Haverford School from a sports perspective, with them at the time being, you know, top five team in the country on the lacrosse side. And I played baseball in the summers instead of, you know, the club lacrosse circuit. So I was handed a stick by John Nostrand, and he's like, look, you're pretty good on defense and basketball. Like, here's a lacrosse stick. And I didn't know anything about it. And I was always a baseball player, but going to your question, I think the mechanics are really similar, right? Whether you shoot or it's just the weight shift in the game of stealing a bag, right, from first to second in baseball as a base runner is very similar to that decision-making when sliding defensively, right? It's that one small movement that a dodger will make that's similar to, you know, a pitcher making his way to the home plate when pitching that you can take off for second or you can go into that slide, right? And that's just like one mental and physical piece where baseball actually does connect with lacrosse. And obviously the other one is shooting, right? You think of pitchers and their motion, their follow through, the weight shift of all the momentum towards the cage for set feet shooters in lacrosse. Very similar, obviously, like different muscles, right? Different, you know, different tendon use and all of that, but very similar just in terms of like how the brain works in using your muscles towards momentum. So, yeah, I was a big baseball guy. I don't know if lacrosse was even in my top two. I think it was like baseball. I loved basketball. I loved football. And then lacrosse came down to it. And in today's world, if you look at lacrosse, like it's kind of one of the purest student athlete sports that's, you know, sponsored by a lot of schools. So when I went into the recruiting process, like baseball was hot, football was hot from like a D3 perspective. And then lacrosse, you know, I had some really big schools reaching out to me that I thought I'd never have the chance to attend. So I had the opportunity to go through that process. But yeah, that's when I kind of dove into lacrosse. I would say my junior year of high school, senior year of high school. And then when I got to Penn State as a player, that's where all I did was play lacrosse. So I think I got a lot better in college than I was in high school because I was focused on so many other things.
How do you describe getting to know Coach Tambroni and ultimately what it was like to be in any line?
It was great. I was a part of that first kind of wave of recruiting for Coach Tambroni. So it was an interesting time. The Big Ten hadn't been formed yet. We were in the CAA at the time. And we started to kind of play those bigger teams, bigger name, you know, lacrosse, blue blood school. So it was fun. It was competitive. I played with a ton of guys from a ton of different areas. And I look back to my time with where guys were coming from and the recruiting that Coach Tambroni did. And I kind of feel similar to that now when going through the process as a coach of being, you know, first time head coach, but going through that first recruiting class of what do we want? What do we need? Where do we go and find that need? Where do we go and find the wants, right? Is it right in our backyard? Or is it, do we have to go kind of far and wide to kind of find these things and talk to a lot of people? But, you know, playing for Coach Tambroni was incredible. The word accountability was just drilled into our minds in the best way. It wasn't just kind of repeated. He showed us what it was like to be accountable, from a coach to player, you know, relationship, but also just person to person relationship and what you need in the future from an accountability standpoint. You know, I'm a young father too. And like, you've got to be accountable 24/7 for your family. And I learned a lot of that through Coach Tambroni. So I appreciate everything he did for me as a coach. And then even in the coaching world as a mentor right now.
So then, you know, after dabbling in the professional world, outside of college coaching, post-graduation, I believe your first college coaching job was with Coach Nostrand at Washington College, correct?
It was. Yep.
How did that come to be? What was that experience like? And how did his influence, both having played for him in high school and then learning to be a college coach alongside him, inform? I guess for this portion, we'll stick specifically to your approach to recruiting.
Yeah, definitely. I was in the club/high school coaching world outside of Raleigh. And at that point, I was coaching a ton of kids. And I was really excited to see Coach Nostrand was awarded the head coach position as alma mater. So I reached out to him and said, hey, you know, congratulations first and foremost, but here's a list of kind of D3 caliber guys that I think would be a great addition. And they have that mentality of myself, and I played for you, and I kind of knew Coach Nostrand. And after I sent him the list, I would say maybe like 2, maybe 3 minutes later, he called me and kind of offered me an assistant coach job. And I took it without knowing where Chestertown, Maryland was and doing this thing. So I always knew coaching at the college level was something I wanted to do, but that's how I kind of got into it. You know, talked to my wife at the time and a couple friends that were in the world, and they were like, dude, you love to coach. You got to be on the field. You got to do this thing. If you're going to do it, you know, dive in, go head first. So moved up to Chestertown from Raleigh and, you know, coached there for a couple of years. But I would say from a recruiting standpoint, it's about quality, right? You want the best player, but it's also, what do you need on your current roster? Like, what are you missing, right? Are we missing a stretch shooter offensively? Are we missing, you know, a clean dodger, somebody that can see the field, right? Defensively, it's like, do we need size, right? Do we need speed? Do we need athleticism? Do we need somebody that can handle the rock with a pole? So at Washington College, I always say this, D3, it was a little bit of the Wild West, right? There's not the same rules. There's not the same restrictions. So you can kind of reach far and wide trying to recruit a ton of different areas, people in your backyard, people that you know are probably Division One or Division Two caliber players earlier. So at least you can get in their ear a little bit. So if things maybe don't go their way or you get them to campus earlier, they might fall in love with the campus or the coaching staff or maybe the guys on the team, right? So I took the approach with Coach Nostrand of let's reach out to 200 to 400 kids a week that we haven't before or we're following up. And that meant honestly like texting kids that we were watching play at the time, right? You have those roster books, it has the phone numbers, and it's like this kid checks the box for athleticism and he has stick skills better than any of our guy on our team. He might not have the size or anything, but he fits the need we need right now. So let's just shoot him a text now and we'll follow up with him after the event, right? It's like that was the fun part of not having the September 9th rule and trying to load up a roster of guys with things you need in terms of skill development and just to piece kind of a winning program together. So that was a lot of fun early. And then once we filled that roster after, you know, my first probably year and a half, that's when the talent started to kind of flow. That's when the pieces started to come together because we were bringing in kids that just graduated high school and some kids were committing that were, you know, juniors just going in their junior year of high school. So we had a great kind of thing going in terms of flow from the recruiting standpoint. But recruiting for Coach Nostrand taught me two things, right? You always have to put yourself in the recruit's shoes, right? In the recruit's family's shoes, what's their situation and hear them out, be a great listener and not so much a talker at points during the process. And then number two, can you help this person not just for the 4 years, but for the rest of their life when they come back to you, if they need help, even after they graduated. So it's got to be somebody you want to be a part of their life for a long time. And you hope that they want you as a part of their life for a long time. So really sitting down and getting to know them as people, not just athletes.
And from there, you went to High Point to be an assistant on John Torpy's staff. He's been on this podcast previously. And one of the themes of that conversation is one of the reasons that I think, you know, I've developed a pretty close relationship with him over the last two decades is because of a non-conventional approach. He isn't, you know, a adherent to power host programs either on the high school or club side, but he has a pretty specific point of view on the type of player that he thinks you can win with. How do you describe what you learned from him and how you work together as a group in order to make the Panthers a better team?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was only there for 1 year and it was towards the tail end of the summer. So I had to shift gears from recruiting Division III, where I'm reaching out to 200 to 400 kids, to looking at my first, at the time, September 1st date, and looking at, okay, my talent pool just shifted a ton. And after sitting down with Coach Torpy, he kind of explained that to me, which you just mentioned. It's like, okay, how much do we need to teach this player when they get here if they're coming from that non-conventional area, right? If we get somebody from a hotbed like Long Island, Philly, Baltimore, right, upstate New York, and you know they're going to get great coaching and they're going to see, I'll just stick to like a goalie for a great example. If they're going to get goalie coaching because they're in a hot area, right, they have goalie coaches around, guys that play the sport. If they play for a high school team where, say, there's 6 or 7 Division I caliber offensive guys shooting on them every day, whether they're the starter or not, they're getting quality shots all spring, right? And if they're in one of those hotbed areas, they're probably playing for a great club where, again, even at their age level, they're going to get some really good quality shots constantly. So you probably don't need to rep or teach something or show something new to that type of player as much. So is it great getting them? Absolutely. But most of those kids are going to those blue blood type, or that's their goal, right? And they're using that to their advantage. It's, can you get somebody who is extremely coachable, right? And that's working different camps and clinics. So he pushed me out to the world and said, hey, go, you know, go and work with Rotelli at Advanced, right? He's going to put you in front of a ton of kids out there and come back and see like how many guys you have, right? So, and that's out in California versus Greensboro, North Carolina, right? And it's the same thing with Texas with Coach Saran down there. It's like he put me in front of a lot of people and connected me with a ton of people within his network where he pulled guys from. And we never really found that polished gem. There was always something, I don't want to say wrong for lack of better words, but there was something we needed to work with that player for, but it was so much more enjoyable. So like the freshmen, my 1 year at High Point were so much fun to work with because they were from all over the place, New Jersey, Minnesota, right? They had so much energy. They were excited to be there. And all they wanted was to get better, which I thought was really cool. So using your connections was a big thing that Coach Torpy said. He's like, they might not coach the kid directly, but they might coach against that kid or they know the family, right? That's more of a connection because they have such a pulse in those areas that I think he was able to kind of tell me, you got to dive deeper versus what you just see on the field at a showcase, right? Or with, you know, Project Missouri, where a lot of those guys aren't going to get recruited over the Baltimore kids. So he taught me that, plus the healthy balance of like, hey, we, depending on the position, we kind of need, you know, somebody from those hotbed areas because it's more quickly of a need. We might not have the time to develop. So that's where you kind of compete with, you get into the water with other schools in terms of recruiting. So I would say right off the bat, that's what Coach Torp kind of taught me the most. And then that next cycle, you know, going into the summer, we had a little bit of a plan based on what we needed with guys graduating, but we ended up heading north to Providence to coach at Brown. So again, shifted.
And you tee me up perfectly. What were the shifts?
The talent was, it was a lot of fun to recruit the talent, right? It was guys that we thought would be a stretch for us at High Point just based off of, again, those hotbed areas. So we were able to recruit some really high caliber guys, but we, you know, Coach Torb kept harping and kept pushing us to recruit guys that fit that mold. We could maybe just go for a little bit more caliber player. So instead of getting the 6 foot midfielder, we were able to look at the 6 foot three midfielder with a little bit more intangibles, even if they were from Missouri, right? Or from California, right? We were just able to get that next level up and look at the fact that you kind of mentioned earlier, like we had 9 days less than the other teams. So we need them to be a little bit more developed from an IQ and physical standpoint to get onto the field. So it was frustrating at times. It was a lot of fun at times. The September 9th was very different. You know, I had to reach out to maybe 75 to 100 defensemen September 1st when I was at High Point. I think my first year at Brown, I reached out to maybe like 20 total, right? Short stick D middies, poles, and close D guys. So that was new to me because I thought it was too small of a list. But in the Ivy League, you get those kids to campus relatively quickly, right? They want to come and see what it's about. And, you know, then it's up to the head coach to kind of make those decisions on the direction it goes. So that was new to me. I was a little bit like anxious and eager to hopefully get those guys so I didn't have to go back to my notes too deep and be like, who did we miss on? You know, it's like you never want to miss, right? You always want to prepare. But so that was new. It was exciting. It was fun. And then the summer between our first and second year, that's when it really ramped up where you could hone in on like, okay, what do we need? Okay, where do we want to go? How far do we want to go? How many of this type of player can we find? Is this the only one? Or is there 50 of this type of midfielder that we could kind of watch continuously and then rank and then look at it that way, right? So that was the fun part of going from High Point to Brown. And then, of course, the grades, right? You might fall in love with somebody from a player on the field. It might be a family that one of those coaches and contacts puts in front of you and you ask their grades and the grades just aren't there. And it's like you have to just take them off the list. Like you can't get too emotional about wanting to recruit a player that, you know, they kind of check all the other boxes, but at, you know, an Ivy League school, you have to really buy in to the academic side too. It just makes things a little bit easier on the administrative side. But more importantly, you know, you can be confident having a conversation with those families about the admissions process based on their grades. So that's always kind of that last box to check, but sometimes it's the hardest one to swallow.
And then you become the head coach at Mercer. What was the process of that like, and how did you discern whether or not you wanted to be a head coach, or how you wanted to, you know, how did you discern that you wanted to be a head coach, and why was this the opportunity that you ultimately jumped at?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of factors. The one thing I absolutely love about Coach Torp is he is someone that will always, whether you're a player, you work for him, just somebody that he's mentoring, he's always encouraging people to bet on themselves. So, you know, the coaching carousel time of year always comes around, and a lot of people have probably said to me, like, you're crazy for leaving a coordinator position in the Ivy League to go, you know, anywhere, right, that isn't of like similar caliber. And this is why I love Coach Torp. He's like, dude, go down, interview, get a feel for the place, see how you feel. You're going to be excited. It's like recruiting, right? It's just like anything, right? It's like getting a new car. It's like when you get in that new car, all you want to do is do it, right? But when I came down here during my interview process, it was late in the summer, like very late. I think I'd seen you up in Newport, and I told you, like, I'm not here tomorrow. I'm going down there. And it would have been easy for me to just say, like, no, I'm good. I'm in a great spot, which I was. You know, I was working for somebody that was teaching me a lot every day. I was working alongside guys that have had the vision to build Brown into an unbelievable program, which they'll do. And but when I came down here, there was an administrator that showed me around, who's now the AD, that kind of showed me the vision for this program, for the school, that I wasn't expecting. I'll be honest, I thought Mercer would never really understand the sport of lacrosse coming down here talking to people. But now there's an athletic director who really understands what this sport could do for an institution. So I fell in love with kind of like the people down here. Everybody I met was very welcoming, and it's an athlete school that where everybody loves going to games, right? The town revolves around athletic games and whatnot. So it was a great culture around here from an athletics point of view. So there was that piece. And then just the opportunity, right? I think the A-Sun as a conference is really interesting. It's, you know, it has Utah, which is considered like a Power Four type school. And then it has Queens, which is like a smaller school. And then there's Mercer, that medium size, Bellarmine, same thing. And there's Jacksonville, who's done a great job in the past couple of years of kind of putting things together. And they won an NCAA tournament last game. So it's a very competitive, upbeat, interesting lacrosse conference that also has an academy in it, right? So like you look at recruiting of this place, and everybody said, like, oh, have you been to Macon? It's so hard to get to. I'm like, people fly into Philadelphia or Baltimore and drive an hour and a half over the Bay Bridge or down 95 to go to Frederica DE Turf. Like, I can't imagine it's any different than flying into Atlanta and driving an hour 15 to go to a school it's warm all the time, it's sunny. It's like an athlete-based school. It's a great education that a lot of people don't understand, which is another part of it. Kind of sucked me in coming from Brown, where, like, if you were a regular student, it's hard to get in here. It's really hard to get in here. So they support athletics getting through the admissions process, but everybody was kind of giving me reasons not to do it. And who I am, having a chip on my shoulder all the time and wanting to bet on myself, I was looking at all the positive that could come of this. And since I took this position, obviously spoke to my family about it a lot, and these opportunities don't come around a lot. I spoke with Coach Torp about a ton of times, and it kind of works parallel to his career, right? Being at Dartmouth and, you know, taking a chance at a brand new program in High Point. And, you know, Mercer's been around for a good amount of time now, but very similar in terms of moves from Ivy League to kind of a A-Sun type conference, right? Newer program, but younger program, right? Looking for some guidance towards success, maybe not to survive, but to thrive, right? So I love that challenge. And I was able to kind of make this move for my family, for a career, in a sense of I want to build something here. And that's a big part of our recruiting strategy this year is everybody. And I don't want to cut you off in terms of your questions you'll have, but like looking at the 5-5 and these new rules, it's like, I think there's so much flexibility and innovation that's going to come with recruiting. And my point earlier, it's like, it's really not that hard to get to this place that everybody says compared to people flying in from Florida to go to DE Turf, right? It's kind of similar. So I hope that answers your question as best I could, but it's been unbelievable being here for a month. We get to start a lot earlier than at Brown. I heard it was like 50 degrees in Rhode Island the other day, and it was 75 today, and you would have thought the guys were wearing sweatshirt and sweatpants. But, you know, it's been fantastic so far. Macon's a choose your own adventure type of city. It reminds me of, you know, some southern cities like revamping like Durham has. So it's a cool little spot.
So the most important thing that any new coach can do is build out their staff. And you brought with you Alec Tocco, who is the Tocco, who was the director of ops at Brown, and then added Sam Jones, who was the head coach at recently renamed Batten University, formerly Virginia Wesleyan. How do you describe those choices and how you've kind of structured your staff with respect to the approach to recruiting?
Yeah, that's I was excited you asked that because I think these two guys are going to be extremely important to this program and the build. So I'll start with Coach Tocco. He's a coach. Like he was in a director of ops role with the staff prior to when we got to Brown. We kind of kept him on. And you could tell when we got there, he wanted to learn a ton. And he had over the past 2 years and worked with our goalies in Connor Foley and, you know, Andy Demopoulos and a ton of guys like Tucker Williams, who I think is excellent. And he brought like a confidence to that goalie room that was impressive because he showed how much he cared for those guys more than just like a director of operations role. I think he did a great job, you know, doing that as well, but he was a coach. He was always hungry to learn more, do more. He's great when it comes to using film to kind of correlate to things on the field, X's and O's. He's got a mind in the recruiting world of, you know, he's an upstate New York guy. So he always wants to go after upstate New York guys. I'm like, Alec, no offense, man. We can't have a team in Georgia with 15 upstate New York guys in one class. Like I'm sure in a perfect world, that'd be great, but he's always looking towards the future. So he's like, he'll make as many phone calls as you need to make sure that it might not be this class we get one, but maybe there's somebody in the next class. And he's just always kind of preaching how great this place is and spreading the word, which I think is awesome. And he's a road warrior. Like he wants to work. He wants to get out there. He wants to evaluate as best he can. I think his evaluations are probably the strongest part of his overall coaching piece. Like when he watches a guy, he fixates on what they do and what they do well, right? What they need to work on. But he's never putting guys into buckets where like we could never recruit him, right? We could never like work with this guy. It's always like the amount of work it's going to take when we have them for 5 years. How much time do we need to put in with them, right? So I think he does a great job there, and he's got a lot of energy. So just in terms of practice, like I think guys like his energy, his juice, and again, on the field, off the field, always looking to learn. And then Coach Jones has been a friend of mine for a long time. You know, for like a lot of people have asked me, they're like, dude, how did you hire a Navy SEAL? I'm like, well, I was nice to him, right? It's like you're nice to people that you know could hurt you. That's always how it works. But I learned this from Coach Torp too. Always hire people that are smarter than you, right? And I think what he had done at, you know, formerly Virginia Wesleyan, now Batten, where I think he was telling me the other day, they had like 19 guys on the roster when he first got there as an assistant. And then he became the head coach. And now it's like a fully operational, program where the school has now turned an eye towards lacrosse in favor of that program. Right. So he knows how to build a program. He knows how to lead. He knows how to communicate really well with our guys. So I knew on the field, being a great player at Navy, just having that offensive mind, like I can almost turn my back to that side of the field some days and be okay with it, and vice versa with Coach Tok. Like I hired two guys where their work ethics, I'll never have to worry about the day to day of them being productive, but more importantly, motivating our guys to succeed in some way. So, and then Coach Jones, like, I don't think I've ever not seen him anywhere I've gone, whether it's like a high end event where he's probably not going to get guys, but he's very big on the networking piece, or just bumping into high school coaches and club coaches and saying like, hey, listen, like there might not be somebody on this field for me, but I'm probably going to call a kid just because why not? Right. So like he loves to just reach out to anybody, and he's somebody that, from a recruiting standpoint, is a pit bull. Like he will go far and wide to find a guy. None of these guys have been to Canada yet, and I can't wait to send them up there. Right. So like they're hungry to do things that sometimes in the coaching world, like some guys just don't want to go, right? Like they don't want to go outside of their comfort zone. Or if I say, hey, I need you on a plane to Vancouver, like these guys won't hesitate to do it. Right. Cause I think they respect the fact that I did it a little bit, right? I loved being on the road and I still do. And now they're asking me like, hey, can we get on the road? Can we get on the road? I'm like, guys, it's dead period. We can't do anything right now, right? But I think they're really excited to go out and represent this brand and kind of educate people on, you know, how good the school is. It's not that difficult to kind of get here, right? And then more importantly, just our vision for our guys and what we're going to do.
So that sets the table nicely for talking about the class of 27. So obviously your 26s are already on campus. You mentioned this before we press record, but started practicing around August 20th and going to go into 20-hour weeks next week. So getting to know the group and everything that entails. But, you know, an opportunity, right, with call it a little bit less than two or almost exactly 2 months before signing week to see whether you can augment the group. What have your conversations with the committed 27s that you inherited been like? You've already added, one player to the class, and what's the situation with respect to the ability to add any more 27s, and how you're going about trying to do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, one of the first things I did was just hop on a Zoom with all the currently committed guys and honored their commitments here. You know, I think they didn't do anything wrong. And I'm not saying the previous coaching staff did anything wrong, right? Those guys have goals of their own and they went and accomplished those things. But I think those players, without proper evaluation, right, or communication, they should have the ability to at least come here and compete in some matter, right? Is it tough? Yes. Because just like any coach, there's always a control piece of kind of knowing like what's coming into your program, what's leaving your program. There's new rules now, right? There's the 5-5 piece of like, do we have enough roster spots? But, you know, I also mentioned them, we're still actively recruiting the 27 class. You know, I've had individual conversations with some of those guys. I've had group conversations with position groups just about like, hey, don't be surprised if we continue to recruit, you know, midfielders or attackmen or just offensive presence or another D guy. Right. And they've responded really well. I think they've welcomed every single, you know, our one guy that we picked up, they've welcomed him in. You know, the staff was brought on after I communicated with those guys. They're excited to work with the new staff. So the 27 class has been great so far. I think those guys are going to have to work just as hard as anybody else, whether they're quote unquote recruited by our staff or not, right? We're always going to be evaluating that group before they get here. And we're going to be just as excited to coach those guys up when they get here, whether, you know, they were added late or they were one of the first recruits here at Mercer for the 27 class. So we're not going to be doing too much there outside of evaluating, but we will, you know, we're still recruiting 2027s, which I think there's a couple of Division I schools doing that, but you know, we're probably one of the last ones still kind of working there.
So you mentioned that you interviewed in late July, got the job shortly thereafter. I started recording these in early mid-August and said, hey, we got to do one, and you're like, can we do it in November? And I was like, no, we're done. We're done recording and posting these by mid-September. And the implication was that you still needed to get to know the place. How have you gotten to know, like, I guess, how much better will the tours that you give to 28s when they start showing up here in the next few days be than the first one that you gave 6 or 7 weeks ago?
Yeah, that's a great question. Fortunately, I have a really young and hungry staff. You know, so when I took this position, and I give my wife a ton of credit, she moved us down here within 2 weeks, which was awesome, right? So I was able to get on campus, like boots on the ground, and talk with people and sit down, you know, in admissions offices and ask a million questions. And right alongside me, I had Coach Toko, Coach Jones, and my GA, Tyler Steele, who he doesn't know if he's going to get into coaching yet, but I guarantee you he's going to get into coaching. He is so hungry. He loves it. And, you know, he's great at kind of compiling a lot of information and shrinking it down and kind of walking these things around. But I think I just grabbed the right people on campus. I mentioned, you know, our athletic director, Brian Garrity. He's been phenomenal. He's pointed me in the right direction of, if it's anybody in the business school, you know, you're talking to John Wilson Gordon, right? If it's anybody in this school, you're talking to so-and-so, right? So on and so forth. And you have to do the work, right? You have to go meet these people and sit down, and they appreciate it a lot, right? Whether they're considered quote unquote big on campus or small, the more you do that, the better. And all they want to do is help. So I have asked for a ton of help in the past, I would say 3 to 4 weeks, to get prepared, mostly for 9-9 tomorrow. And it's been tremendous. It's not the biggest campus. It's walkable. If you come in August, you don't want to walk it because it's 100 degrees every day. But, you know, it's a beautiful campus. We know where everything is and how it's laid out. The guys on the team have also told us the little ins and outs of things they do and you know, part of that college experience and what they like to enjoy on campus and around campus. So we've had a really great welcoming kind of month with the staff here that has been nothing but supportive and answered all of our questions. So if someone asks me what a certain building is, I have no problem saying, I don't know, and I'll find out. And the great part is all I have to do is just shoot somebody a text or even bump into somebody and ask, and they're willing to help, which is really cool for the school. But I think we've got a great grip on what this place has to offer, what it's going to offer. And most importantly, the caliber of what lacrosse is going to turn into here under the new leadership of Brian Garrity. So we're really excited for tomorrow, right? Just to get people on the phone. And, you know, you feel kind of creepy in this role. You follow kids around for like a year, and like it's almost like the parents know who you are before the kids do, because they're the ones on the sideline there too. So it's great to actually finally communicate with kids and get to know them.
So I recorded one of these podcasts with Ryan Danahy, and we spent a lot of time talking about lacrosse in Georgia. And you touched on it a bit with respect to Macon and its approximate location to Atlanta, but certainly one of the hallmarks for any program, but specifically one in an outlying geographic area, is having an identity within that area, within, in this case, the state of Georgia. How do you describe your approach to that? And how do you expect it to manifest on the phone on September 9th?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you always have to look inside first and out, right? If we don't dive into the greater Atlanta area with the number of clubs that are now operating out of there, I think we're missing out on some great talent, right? A growing market in the South. And I think if it would be like a Weather Channel map of where lacrosse is kind of migrating, it is directly south, right? You look at how competitive Florida is, Georgia is, right? They're pulling from kids from Tennessee. They're pulling kids from Alabama. Obviously the Carolinas have been doing great. And now Texas, like a lot of people forget, Texas is in the South. It's not just on its own over there. So I think the Southeast is becoming an extremely beneficial, like, recruiting spot for us, because people know Mercer University, Right. I think the difference is people in Florida know what Mercer is. They've heard of Mercer. It's a small liberal arts school that has great education. It's hard to get in, you know. Oh, they have lacrosse. It's like, okay, now we're interested, right? So I think being one of the only schools down here, I think there's six in the South, right? In Division One. It's nice, right? You're a small pocket. If you were to say we were in Massachusetts or if we were in Pennsylvania, we'd be one of who knows how many, right? In the Northeast. So the fact we're South, the fact we're near a large city is fantastic because it kind of perks some people's ears up that might want to learn a little bit more about this place. But we do have to conquer our backyard, right? We have to go into Atlanta, and whether it's recruiting events, it's high school games, right? It's running sixes, it's hosting events. You know, my hope is we get to host some high school games if teams are willing to kind of come down here and see the campus and show. There's no local lacrosse here in Macon. I guess there used to be, right? And, you know, parents, kids age out and the program kind of dies. So we want to bring that back. We have people kind of in the works trying to get a pulse on things around here in Macon, right? And then the greater Georgia area is just constantly in contact with people that are up there. You know, constantly in contact with people that are familiar with the school, have been here a long time, love the sport of lacrosse, and want to see the one Division One school in Georgia flourish, right, with tons of Georgia guys on the roster, right? So we have to own that. So we'll dive in a good bit tomorrow. I think this is the first time in 3 years I'm not going to Philadelphia on September 9th. So being a Philly guy, it's like the first time I'm not going there. So I'm going to stay in Atlanta because we got to go after guys that are right here.
So one of the things that I've always enjoyed about my conversations with you is how tactical you are in very direct and specific ways. So I would be remiss not to ask you about your thoughts on the combination of scholarship dollars, the ability to stack financial aid with merit-based aid, the prospect or utilization of NIL or anything along those lines, the implementation of roster caps, as well as 5-on-5. Let's just start with like the scholarship and stacking question. How do you conceive of it? How do you approach it? And you know, not necessarily specific to what your roster looks like now and how you intend to deploy it for the class of 28, but generally, you know, what is a good composition of the financial side of recruiting look like on a spreadsheet that you're maintaining?
Yeah. It's a great question because I've looked at it probably in 15 to 20 different ways on how to do this thing. And I'm so fortunate that I coached in Division III where there are no scholarships. And I'm not saying we don't have any, right? But we're not as fortunate as some other programs, right? Like we need to, I don't want to say stretch the dollar, but we need to be really strategize like what we want to use those dollars for. And then working for Coach Torpy, who was at High Point, when he started High Point, there was no scholarships, right? And now I'm sure they have plenty. So I've really kind of reverse thought about it. Okay. Now we have to look at it for 5 years. So how do we spread that a little bit? Is it worth going to administration early to try and gain more? Or do we have conversations about the stacking piece first? So I kind of gained all my education here at Mercer about the stacking piece first and foremost. And I think it's going to force our staff to be extremely patient in the recruiting process of it's not just about the money. From an athletic standpoint, it's about the merit of, okay, we've got a great student who deserves as much merit opportunity as possible. Let's have them explore and see how bad they want to be here, right? And let's see, not a test per se, let's just see, like, let's give them a great tour, right? Let's have them sit down with our staff. Let's have them meet the guys. Let's have them maybe meet a couple people in the department and show them everything that Mercer has to offer as an institution, right? From an academic standpoint, kind of that D3 model, right? Like, is the investment going to be worth it? Let's say if there was no athletic scholarships, right? There was just merit opportunity, right? So we're taking that approach, especially with the 27 class right now, with some really good talent left in the 27 class that we have these guys coming to campus soon to come visit. And when it comes to the athletic dollars, I'm almost treating it as if we're not going to get any more, right? If I go to administration and say like, hey, we want to do this, they're like, that's all we have. Because in today's climate, let's be honest, like football and basketball, maybe some baseball at some schools and maybe some other sports, like you're seeing softball and maybe some of like the volleyballs, like wrestling of the worlds and like the Big Ten, they're starting to get the NIL side of it plus scholarships and whatnot. In lacrosse, you're not seeing it too much, right? On the women's side, you are, but in men's lacrosse, maybe one or two are being added, right? There's the NIL side. We don't have too much of an NIL side because if we do, it's probably going to go towards, you know, football that's done fantastic here, basketball, which has done great here. You know, these sports that they go to the NCAA tournament year after year, right? And they're producing a lot of financial value to the school. So we're going in saying like, look, this is what we have. This is what we have to work with. Let's not get discouraged because we don't have X amount of dollars. Like there are tons of kids out there that want to be here, that will see kind of this place and what it has to offer. They'll meet our staff and they'll believe in what our vision is. So let's be patient, right? There's rankings, right? There's guys with stars. There's guys with stars on our list. There's guys we want to go after, right? But if someone throws them a ton of money early for 5 years, right, and we can't compete with that, it's like you almost have to be okay with moving on. Or if it's somebody that really wants to be here and they have an offer sitting, that's when we're going to make it work for that family, right? If it's that mutual want to be here. So we're almost taking like a Division III approach, kind of sitting back and seeing like, hey, here's the full picture. This is what you could earn from a merit standpoint. But there are some players, right, that are, I think, not maybe not this class, but the 29 class. We're going to know what we really need after being here for one full season, right, and having a season under our belt and saying like, you know, we really need a stretch shooter or we really need a close, you know, number one defenseman or an LSM that's unbelievable on the wings, right? And it's like, okay, maybe that shifts the money focus a little bit earlier in the recruiting process. But I think for right now, we're going to be patient. Like we're going to be patient as a staff. And unfortunately, I have a young staff that's itching to all they want to do is get guys to campus and get them an answer. And it's like, that's great. But I really need to see when people get here how much they love what they saw or want to be a part of it. And I'm big on the ride home, you know, whether it's the home to Atlanta or it's to the airport, the flight home, or if people are driving from Florida and it's maybe a 6 or 8 hour drive. And it's like, take that drive home. And can you see yourself here for 5 years? Can you see yourself hanging out with me for 5 years? Right. Like if it's, you know, it's different being in my office for an hour and a half and talking and everything's great. But like, you know, when it gets hard, can you see those times where you turn to mom and dad and say like, hey, the coaching staff really helped me get through these tough moments. Like, I love these guys. Like I bleed orange and black, right? We want people to bleed orange and black before they get out of here. And that starts in the recruiting process. So we want to be patient and make sure we get that full feel. We want people to come here, get as much information as possible, understand the financial piece of it, not just for 4 years, but 5 years now. And then take that trip home before you give us that answer, right? We want people that are here for the right reasons and because our whole staff is.
Incredibly well said. It does set a really nice table for the next question, which is with so much anxiety around how many total spots there are going to be in the class of 2028 and how fast they're going to go, the term patience is persona non grata or term non grata for a lot of folks. I feel like the anxiety that's been ratcheted up is much more substantial. What do you, number one, like how many players in the class do you anticipate taking by X date? And let's call X whenever you pause the recruitment until you resume it again, whenever that is, right? So these, you know, there's kind of a couple windows. So call it September and October before the evaluation window opens again. And then that runs through, call it, you know, mid December. And then effectively, you know, no more evaluation depending on when spring practice starts and your ability to get to a couple of the events that exist in January until next summer, while also still evaluating from afar with respect to high school games. So let's just talk about it in the context of that, you know, October 31st time cutoff. You know, how many commitments do you anticipate having, and what does patience look like in that 2-month window?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I have to bring this up, but like, there's too many great players and not enough teams. Like, we know this. We talk about this all the time. Plus, we talk about the classes filling up in a month. I think patience is going to be big for us. Where in my perfect bubble, right? That perfect timeline from now until, let's say, like next summer, right? Next June. Like mid-June, right? That's when you feel like a lot of classes kind of finish up for what would be the 28th next summer. It's like, I would love to have 4 or 5 committed guys, maybe by the end of October, like right before we hit the road in November, to reevaluate some people that are on our list. Like after we have a prospect camp, getting kids on campus, maybe meeting kids and, you know, they loved it, but they want to go on some other visits. And it's like, we'll show them love by getting on the road and seeing them, or maybe get them down here again, right? So like maybe 5 to 6 guys by November. I think this class is going to be a little bit bigger than usual, than a lot of people are kind of talking about, just for us. Because again, not sure what we need, right? It's kind of about what we want as a part of our program. And it goes back to kind of my answer before of, if by the end of October we find like 12 guys in terms of balance, like, you know, a goalie, a faceoff guy, all those different, you know, numbers per position per se, if we find 12 guys that all they want to do is get better, be a part of this thing, they already bleed orange and black because they loved being down here. They're itching to come back. Like, we'll be okay with that. You know, if they show us like this is what they want to be a part of. And I don't mean the kids that come in with like the script of questions that you can find online, right? And like the script, and they like look at mom to like answer the question or dad to answer the question every single time. It's like, I want kids that are in here nervous because it's their first big decision of their life, right? And like when they leave and they have all the information, and if we can get 12 kids, right, that by the end of October, that all they want to do is be Mercer Bears, it's like, and they're guys that were on our list and we hunted and we went after, right? Like, I'll be psyched. Like, I'm going to be excited, and we might be done early and we can shift to the 29s. But I think the word patience is kind of the theme for myself and the staff. It's like, the first question I'm going to ask before, you know, throwing an offer at a kid, or if the kid shows they really want to be here, is like, okay, do we need them? How much do we want them there? Can we find better? Or can we sit back, right, and see if somebody develops? Like, I'm, again, biased, right? I was a late bloomer. I didn't commit till my senior year, right, as a high school kid. So, like, do we sit and watch Maverick 28s next year, right, where I feel like that event for us will be awesome. Like, it'd be great to kind of watch and see who's developed or who's got a chip on their shoulder for not getting recruited at all during this year in this time frame, and they come out and they're invited to that thing, or just any event, right? That time of year where kids are under recruited and you find somebody who's tougher physically and mentally and maybe grew a little bit. It's like, I think the world of the late bloomer is going to come back a little bit in college lacrosse, because people are either going to sit back and kind of wait and see what happens, or they're going to go after and classes are going to close up. But I think perfect world, if we've got 5 or 6 guys by the end of October, awesome. Like, I think we're going to leave it and go to those events and evaluate and have conversations and have a couple people in the winter, maybe for visits or right before the season starts, and then focus on our season as the high school players should focus on theirs. And then early summer, you know, finish our class out maybe by the end of June. I think that's in my mind, like that perfect timeline. But like I said, it's going to change. Like, tomorrow people might actually pick the phone up that we weren't expecting to, and it's like, you want to come down, great, like, this is awesome, you know, like, And if that happens, we're going to be excited either way, as long as they show us this is how important this is to them.
I think that's a great note to end on. James Jakey, thanks so much for taking the time on the How Recruiting Works podcast. Really appreciate your thought and insight.
Thanks, Terry.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.